Welcome. We are here for our September Wine, Women, and Song podcast. With me today, I have...
Heather Lockard Wheeler.
Zoe Stewart.
Paige Stroop Bittner.
And we also have a special guest with us today. I will let her introduce herself.
Hi, my name is Megan Enan. I'm a mezzo-soprano. I lived in Baltimore for almost 8 years and recently moved back to Iowa. I run a blog called The Sybaritic Singer, which the tagline is, if classical music really were dead, I'd have more time for yoga and bourbon.
Amen.
I like that. Yeah. And we'll put on our blog a link to your website so that if you want to find out more about Megan, then that's a great place to go. Absent this evening are Jessica Sataba, regular, and Catherine Davis, who has decided to step down as a regular, but we welcome her back as a guest in the future. And Jessica had a other singing commitment that sprang up at the last minute. But we have a great group, and our theme this evening is sins and zins.
Oh boy.
And so we'll be tasting Zinfandel wines. A little history of Zinfandel wines. If you don't know, most people think of Zinfandel as a Californian grape, but actually it has a very ancient history in Europe. The grape is native to Hungary, and also is known in... What was that like?
That's my people.
That's your people?
That's okay. Some of my people.
So this must be your wine.
Any wine's my wine.
So, but also it found a home in Italy, where it's known as Primitivo, and that is genetically the same grape as Red Zinfandel. And so it came to the United States in 1829. It just kind of hit the East Coast, but it found its true home in the U.S. in California in 1850, where it thrived and was the major planted grape for quite some time. And it was very popular until Prohibition hit. And at that time, a lot of the grapevines were pulled up. Though not mainly for Prohibition purposes, mainly because some people don't know during Prohibition you were actually allowed to make wine in your home. So a lot of grape growers still sold grapes to people to make wine in their homes. The problem was Zinfandel as a grape didn't travel very well, so a lot of people pulled it up to grow grapes that would travel well. But and you guys, a lot of things that are prized in Zinfandels, if you're not a Zin lover or drinker, are old vine Zins.
Yes.
So they have to be, you know, 50 years or more old, and sometimes some of the grapevines are 100 plus years old.
Wow.
And this would be because they've been, you know, planted so early and survived Prohibition. You know, after Prohibition, it kind of lulled, and it wasn't until actually the advent of white Zinfandel that afterwards, Red Zinfandel got a resurgence. White Zinfandel was invented by Bob Trinchero of Sutter Home. He actually was making some Red Zinfandel, and he was trying to find a way to make it more red in color. So he bled off some of the juice so that the skin would have more contact with the remaining juice. And with that juice that didn't have much color in it, a blush-type wine, he fermented it. And then he tried that in 1972, and then in 75, the version he had, the fermentation stopped early, which left extra residual sugars. Mm. And he kind of tasted and was like, well, actually, this is not so bad. So he had trademarked it originally with White Zinfandel because they forced him to make an English name for it on the copyright. Mm. And that's how it was born. White Zinfandel still outsells Zinfandel, Red Zinfandel, to this day about 6-1,
and
that
tragedy.
And
tragedy.
And White Zinfandel accounts for almost 10% of wine sales by volume in the United States.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's kind of insane. I much prefer the red variety.
Yes.
Yes.
Which returned, you know, and had its rise in the late 80s, early 90s. So we're tasting Zinfandels tonight, all from California, where it really has its great home. And also, I think, given a lot of the selections you guys chose, I think it'll go well with tonight. So really, really looking forward to tasting and listening with you. So without further ado, I think we should move into our first piece.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, that was pretty powerful.
That's Zoe's selection.
Wow, Zoe, I'm
just, it's pretty awesome, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that is the fifth movement of Benjamin Britten's Serenade for Tenor, Horn, and Strings. Mm-hmm. And it's the movement is entitled Dirge, and it's based on a poem, 15th century anonymous poem. I forget the name. I'll look it up though. Of the poem.
Lake Wake Dirge.
Oh, thank you. Yes, there it is. And
or Lake Wake Dirge.
Yeah, it's an LYKE.
Yep.
Not sure. This is, it was premiered in 1943 with Peter Pears, who is the tenor, and Dennis Brain.
No surprise there.
Yeah, so, and then the BBC Orchestra. I don't know, it's a very powerful, you know, the repetitiveness of the, of the melody, and then all of the sort of, and supported by the orchestra, and how it kind of like starts so kind of sparsely and then gets so active in the middle and then kind of sort of fades out a little bit at the end, and it just has this like really beautiful kind of creepy haunting you know, quality, and with our theme. So the message of the text is sort of be kind and generous to the poor or you will be sent to hell.
Yeah, it's basically very eye for eye kind of thing, you know. If you don't give of yourself or your goods to the poor, then you'll, you know, be in the fires of hell. And the reading I did about this poetry a while ago, when I wish I had sung this piece someday, maybe I'll do it. But I was in school with Taylor Brickley, and he was studying and doing it, and this poem was one that was apparently told graveside. You can kind of, what you were talking about really fits in with that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So now Benjamin Britten did write a lot for the guitar too, and so that's how I kind of became first. He has a couple of song cycles for high voice and guitar. And
go figure.
Which
voice
I played.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. Exactly. And he also did actually probably like the best solo piece that we have, the Britten Nocturnal, which any guitar fans out there, I highly recommend listening to it. It's a very kind of, it's sort of newer, like tonal language, but it's a really profound, really profound piece. But anyway, so I really like Peter Pear's voice. Because I think it's really expressive. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think it's really distinctive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes. But do singers like Peter Pear's voice?
Well,
like,
do
tenor?
Do.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a bigger voice tenor, so I tend to like bigger voice tenors as well. But I like Peter Pear's, and sometimes I feel like, I'll be honest, sometimes I feel like when I've heard roles, I'm like, and Peter Pears, you know, premiered this? Really? And that's because he was sleeping with Benjamin, right? So, you know, I was just what I thought.
Let's
you know,
just
get
that out.
You know? So, you know, but it's one of those things, but the more recordings I heard of him, he had a very versatile voice, and it was never extremely big, but it always had a wonderful cut to it. And even in this, when the strings get pretty intense and the horn comes in when it's talking about purgatory and everything, you lose a little bit, but you still hear his core voice coming through, so he doesn't get lost, and that's actually not a bad quality. I mean, it's kind of something that, like, oftentimes, you know, when people talk about singing big stuff like Wagner and stuff, you have to stop thinking about singing over or louder than the orchestra, because you know, the orchestra's 100 plus pieces, they will win.
Yeah,
every
time.
So it's a matter of finding your home within the instrumentation and the orchestration, to just like any other instrument would. Just like you'd be like, oh, and it's this, you know, beautiful, rich sound, but you can hear the, you know, the oboes, and you can hear the violas, and you can hear the trumpets, but they're all playing together.
Right.
And it's about remembering that you can have that color within, and he does that extremely well.
in this piece and many others.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's a very easy piece to sing. So,
oh no.
As a singer, I'm like, oh, better you than me.
Very exposed.
It is very. It actually reminds me of a little bit of Carmina Burana as well.
Yeah,
that,
I can see that too.
The tenor, right? The goose. What is it?
Yeah,
the goose aria.
Yeah,
the swan. Swan.
That's
goose.
It, yeah.
Swan. Whatever. where it's exciting to hear and very, it makes a huge impact, but then at the end of, you know, knowing the work that goes into it, you're like, glad you're doing it than me. He does have an interest, and if I've heard him more, I'm not recognizing, but he in this recording, it almost seems like he's got a little bit of vocal tension.
Yes.
I don't know if that's how it's written.
You hear that in a lot of his.
Okay.
I think so. When you hear him in the Britten operas.
Okay.
That's that quality that he lends to a lot of those characters.
Okay.
I think maybe that's what also Britten hears in that voice, is that he really likes
that tension.
That extra bit of tension, and also a little bit of that cut. That, like, it's not a huge voice, it's the voice that, like, just gets right in between the ribs or something.
Well, and I'm sure if people wanted to be critical, they'd be like, oh, he has tension in his voice, you know. But, I mean, friggin', you know, Plácido Domingo sings and his tongue is at the roof of his mouth, so you're never supposed to do that either, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I really loved the horn solo. Mm-hmm. Because if you've read my bio, you'll know that I played horn.
And if you haven't, gentle listener, friend us on Facebook. There's links to everything that you need to know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think this piece is important for horn, just because, like, this, like, Dennis Brain, who was
such a great horn player.
Yeah, so he was sort of the first kind of solo horn player.
Yeah.
And so this was kind of this was him playing in this recording.
Well, I think that's what lends a lot to the eerie quality when you get some of the, you know, the very kind of naked voice, then you get some, it doesn't seem like, you know, full strings at the beginning, it's individual instruments from the different sections, and the first horn entrance is kind of really light and eerie. It's got a kind of hollow sound.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not beautifully written. It's just wonderfully, exceptionally performed here.
Yeah, I agree.
It has a little bit of that symphony fantastique, like march to the gallows.
Oh yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
Element to it.
That's a great point.
Yeah, and I liked that a lot. That you can really hear it, and it, that kind of bounces around through the different voices, and I like that.
Yeah, that definitely sets the scene.
It's not good. Way to start out with something like
that. Yeah, it's even like October, because it's sort of like...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Halloween.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it is Halloween.
Well, you know, it's late September. Some people will listen in October.
Sure. Yeah, enough.
So what do we think of wine number one?
Yummy.
It is
yummy.
Really tasty. It's funny, because I know we always say we're not pairing the wines to the music, but to me, like, this has a really dark quality to it. Maybe it's dark fruit is probably a better description.
Yes.
And I felt like that went really well with the music.
Zinfandel seems to have, and I'm not going to articulate it well at all, so I'm going to try, so just bear with me. It has that, it almost tastes like it's carbonated. It's got like that,
a fizz to it.
A fizz, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I actually, it's funny, I just led a South African wine tasting the end of last week, and somebody said the same thing about wine, and clearly, like this one, it's not effervescent, there aren't bubbles in it.
No.
But what I told them, you know, I think of that as when a wine's acidity seems to have, like, angular or sharp points versus rounded points, and And if you were to think about that in terms of acidity of, like, say, fruits, like, there's a different acidity to a citrus fruit than there is to a raspberry, than there is to an apple, and the whole realm of apples between Granny Smith to, say, Honeycrisp, and there's whole different acidity into a tomato, which is even much rounder and softer.
So then really
this
what
is
I'm tasting is acidity.
Acidity, yeah.
I liked it because it was... it was full, it's nice, full-bodied, and then that acidity kind of gives it a nice, clean finish. It's,
mm-hmm.
So I enjoyed this one.
No, I think the acidity is balanced. There's soft tannins in it, and I think the acidity is going to balance it well. And the fruits are, they're like red berries because of that brighter acidity.
Yeah.
So kind of
mm-hmm.
raspberries, those kind of red berries versus darker berries like blackberries and blueberries and things. That's it.
But this would be nice with a meal or by itself.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
it'd be very
there.
Well, it's great. I think we should move on to the second selection and the
very excited.
Second
What's
one.
Next?
Nervous and excited.
Nervous and excited.
Gotta be a name for that.
Maybe expectant.
Thank you.
It's from Donizetti's Lucrezia Borgia, and it's the Italian is Il segreto per essere felici, which translates to the secret of being happy. And the singer is mezzo Shirley Barrett.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, if you're not familiar with the opera Lucrezia Borgia, I mean, it's all about sin, like murder and almost incest and, you know.
Almost incest.
Yeah, you know, all kinds of
perfume.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So I felt like that was appropriate. And then the song itself, I mean, it's a drinking song, basically. And the translation of what the, even though it's a mezzo, it's a panzerol, so it's Orsini. And it's the secret of being happy, whether the sky be calm or cloudy. I know by experience and teach it to my friends. Any weather, be it hot or freezing, I joke and I drink and I laugh at madmen who give thought to the future. Let us take no care for an uncertain tomorrow, since today has been given us to enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, drink for today. And the irony of that is the wine they are drinking is poisoned. So
they really are drinking.
So they can
today.
Really only
yes,
enjoy
is,
it today.
Yeah, yeah, they can only drink today. There is no tomorrow. So
she has a lovely voice. That is also another aria that I would rather listen to than sing. There's just so much going on there, and she just had. There are probably two of the higher notes I had issue with, but only two. And just that seamless singing from head to middle to chest was just, was glorious.
Do you think that she spends so much time in chest because it's a pants roll? Like, and then maybe it's harder to flip up into the high stuff?
I don't know.
She wanted to try and butch it up. And
yeah, I mean, I think because, like, there is a lot of it in the way she sings those
lines.
Yeah,
I guess it's funny. Yeah, as a soprano, you know, her low notes would have been the high notes, but those, I mean, her low notes are glorious. So, you know, of course, if I had low notes like that, yes, I would.
You'd be a contralto too? Because the
know.
Role is listed as a contralto.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
She did an amazing job.
It's a great role in the opera.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it twice when WNO did it, because Jay was in it and we were dating. So.
Do you remember who sang it?
And did he do a
yes.
good job?
So I got to see two. He did. He was in the chorus, but he did a great job. But the two, the two sopranos, one was Renee Fleming and the other was Sandra Rodmanowski. They were both fabulous.
Oh, I can see Sandra doing
yeah,
it.
And the mezzo that sang this role was Kate Aldrich.
Oh,
she
yeah.
She was fabulous as well. So
mm-hmm.
it was a really good production.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Well, and it's a perfect song for, you know, drinking and debauchery.
Yeah.
And sin.
And sin, yes.
And the whole opera's about
and
sin.
A male chorus. You always need a male chorus
yeah.
when you're singing about drinking.
Right. Of course.
Yeah. I was surprised none of you picked, like, you know, a drinking song or a Falstaff song or something, you know. Isn't there a song, like a drinking song from the Merry Wives of Windsor that's a bass anyway. That's okay.
There's the drinking song in Tales of Hoffman.
There's that as well.
That's a good one.
There's a lot of drinking songs in opera.
Yeah.
There are. Oh.
Another theme, perhaps.
Right?
Yes. Very
I figure
good.
You guys would have already covered that one.
We do the obvious things later.
When we don't have any ideas.
Oh,
that's
no.
Right. No. So what do we think of wine number two?
I do this every time. I love wine number one, and then wine number two, I'm like, I don't know you. Who are you? I'm mad at you. I'm kind of mad at this one.
You know, it's funny you say that, because most people, when they do a wine tasting, they don't like the first wine, because it's the first wine they've tasted.
Apparently I'm easy.
That's why actually before, that's actually though why before the podcast, I always serve some other wine. You know, when we're meeting.
But I like
so
that one too.
I know, but it's to make sure that the first wine you're tasting when you're in the podcast isn't like, yeah, so we don't get drunk before we do this.
No.
We just have a little bubbly.
Just a little. No, this.
It's much more tannic than the
last
one.
That's what I was going to say too.
Yeah, so you get like the chewiness. So I think that could be a little shocking to the palate.
No, this is lackluster for my palate. I don't know if my palate is actively dying. I don't know, but it's just, I don't know.
Your poor palate.
I need a palate lift.
It tastes a little more oaky to me.
Yeah, there, well, I mean, there's definitely more wood overtones on it. I mean, oaky is one way to put it.
Yeah, and it's less, like, fruity.
Yeah, it's more dusty and brambly is what I would have said.
Definitely dusty. Like my house. Dusty.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that Red Zinfandel is my favorite grape. So
wow,
it is my go-to grape for most things. So I love a good Red Zin.
Well, Red Zin is great. Like, it's one of my favorite cooking wines. You know, to like
to
pour
drink
some in
cook.
And then drink while I put it in because it cooks so well.
You're like a Julia Child quote. Like,
yes,
I love to cook with wine. Sometimes I even put it in the food.
Today we're making a beef bourguignon. I've got half of a bottle. Let's have the other half.
No, but the other thing is, I feel like this is actually a young Zin to be drinking now.
Yes.
Because the fruit is there, but it is really covered up by the wood, by the tannins that are very prominent. But I guess there's a good time to point out that, you know, most people don't think of Zins as having ageability, and they really do.
Hmm.
Or they can, I should say.
Does any wine not have ageability?
Yes.
Yeah.
What? Is that too long of a list? Is that another podcast? You can say, is that a follow-up question?
Well,
for
no,
our
I mean, like, I'll give you the big basic statistics, is that 95%+ of all wines produced are meant to be drank immediately.
Well,
great.
You're
right. So immediately in the wine industry means within the first 2 to 3 years of purchase.
Okay.
And then cellaring is really beyond that. So you're talking about a very small percentage of wines that are designed to be aged. And even the ones that are designed, many of the ones that are designed to be aged aren't designed to be aged, you know, more than 5 or 10 years. It's the very rare few that go beyond 10 years.
Okay.
So this is all statistics by volume. And remember, 10% of the wine by volume in the United States sold is White Zinfandel. I don't know anybody who's aging that.
I really
hope
they're not
selling
white.
That's right.
Welcome to my White Zinfandel cellar. Today we're wearing Margaret's and we're drinking White Zinfandel.
There are plenty of wines that cellar. The things that make a wine cellar well have to do with its structure, and the things that give wine structure in white wines, it's purely the acidity because it doesn't have the tannins from the grape skins, etc., or the wood. There can be a little wood in some of the whites, but it's really the acidity that gives a white wine structure. In red, it's the acidity, which we kind of touched a little bit on in wine number one, and then it's the tannins. And when you taste, you know, very firm tannins, it can be completely out of balance, which I don't think this wine is, because you can still taste the fruit. Mm-hmm. It's just not as evident. What's going to happen as, you know, this wine ages is those tannins actually are plant particles, and so they will settle out of the wine. They'll become sediment.
Uh-huh.
And so the fruit that's there and the acidity that's there will come forward. And if that acidity and fruit wasn't balanced as the tannins fell out, the whole wine would just kind of fall apart and fall flat.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this one actually probably can age, you know, 3 to maybe 7 years.
Okay.
And actually that will give it, you know, that will make this fruit actually express itself more. And it'll come forward.
Okay.
And it'll be a much more wine that you'll be like, oh yeah, I remember you, old friend. As opposed to, who are you? And what did you do to my old friend?
Yeah.
Exactly.
You're like,
welcome.
All right.
Well, with that, I feel like we need to move on to number three. So if you haven't finished, go ahead and dump. And if you have, we'll just move right along.
What will it be?
Dead man walking. Yeah.
Intense at all.
I know. For something really mild. Without a lot of tannins.
Yes. That was my choice.
And if you didn't pick up at the very beginning of it, it's from
Dead Man Walking.
Right.
So that is the... I brought notes, so it's not like I know all this stuff. Gentle listener. So that is the first opera by Jake Hagee. Libretto is Terrence McNally. It's based on the book of the same by Sister Helen, is it Prejean? Prejean, thank you. And then this work premiered October 7th, 2000 at the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco. And the cool thing is that one of the original cast, the gentleman who sang Joseph Desrochers was baritone John Packard. And when we performed this at Baltimore Opera, he was also our Desrochers. And I know him actually from my days living in Philadelphia, working at the Victor Cafe. And he would often come in, and he is a lovely human being and a super talented human being. And I think this opera, when people make suggestions, they say, what are good operas to go to? I've never been to one. And if they are native English speakers, I always try to gear them towards English ones. You know, Streetcar Named Desire is one of my favorites, and actually this is one of my favorites because it is a story that most people know, and then they can connect with because it's in English. And of course the music is just amazing, and the story is compelling, and I think, and it's such a good artistic piece because it really, it takes you through the ringer because you hate him in the beginning. That opening scene is just so compelling and awful, and you, when it's done, you know, and so you hate him, and he goes through this, he finds salvation even though he's condemned to death, he's done a terrible sin, but he does find salvation, and it really makes you question, you know, the death penalty, and then you feel bad for him, you know, for our main character, because if he had been the person at the end of the opera that he was in the very beginning, you know, he would have never gone down this road. And so, and their love story, not, you know, they do love each other, but not romantic love, is just amazing. And she was actually, I think she was in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I think she came to see it.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, so.
Well, she spoke a couple things, you know, when it was here, and she's done that in a number of places.
Okay.
I agree. I think this is a fantastic first opera for people because it is it's easily accessible themes to the modern public.
Yes.
And so many people have seen the movie, so they follow things very well, and it also illustrates, I think, for many people what opera does so well that other mediums can't.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's actually funny, I was chatting with the craft beer specialist who was pairing the beers for Baltimore Concert Opera's recent thing where they pair craft beers with opera.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, you know, I was going through all the different pieces that were being chosen and talking with him about them so he could think about what, you know, beers he would pick. And I talked about the Rigoletto Quartet, and then actually Dead Man Walking came up when I was talking with him, because I was like, one of the cool things about this quartet is there's so many different things going on in the Rigoletto Quartet simultaneously, and that's one of those great things you can do in opera. And he, being an English lit major, was like, oh, that's one of the things I love about, you know, literature, is you can have so many different threads moving simultaneously, whereas when you have the narrative of a TV or a movie, you're only really seeing one. And the scene I mentioned from this is that the courtroom scene where you have both the parents going on, and and it's like you hear all the different emotions and all the different situations going on. You hear some of it individually, but then you hear it interwoven, you know, simultaneously, and that's really how life happens, simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
And I
really liked, I've never seen the opera, I know a little bit about it, but I mean, with this whole scene, like, you know exactly what's happening. Like, I even imagined, you know, where he's walking to the execution chamber, something's happening. You know, when Sambuca, our cat, was meowing, I think she was disturbed. Something intense was happening. So
don't
if you hear the meows, that was her distress about that. But, I mean, and obviously, I mean, the ending, like, is very straightforward, letting you know what's happening. But, that was really powerful to me, I think.
I
think that's very interesting in the opera that they use that sound rather than anything else.
Yeah.
Because it's just it's you've gone from all of this layering down to this very singular point, and that makes it so intense.
Yeah. Very poignant. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I mean, I always remarked when we were doing this opera at Baltimore, I was like, when you got to that huge "Thy Kingdom Come, Thy Will Be Done" moment, I was like, this is so awesome, and it's over so quickly. you know, it's like it comes to this glorious climax, and it's just like gone.
Yeah.
And then it becomes so stark. And I think the Desrochers on this recording from Houston Opera was just so beautifully vulnerable there, you know, in his last statement.
Who is it?
Yeah. I forget. I gotta. Do you have it?
It's Philip Curtin? No, Philip Cutlip. Sorry.
Okay.
gosh, I'm getting old at night. Must need reading glasses or something. Philip Curtin.
It is a tour de force for, I mean, you got to do push-ups and sing and, you know, it's hardcore. I think that's why I love it. It's hardcore, it's raw, it's visceral. Mm-hmm. And I think it's everything what opera should be. And I think if more people experienced something like this, you know, they would be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, so I totally would say, you know, if this is anywhere playing, you know, within a reasonable driving distance of you, you know, go see it.
Yes.
Especially if like one of the singers who's doing a lot right now is Michael Mays, who we've had an opportunity to have sing here in Baltimore once or twice, and he's a phenomenal singer and apparently very well reviewed, and I'm not surprised at all because of, like you say, the push-ups and the, he's very, you know, what do they call it? What's the term? Bear a hunk or something?
Oh, bear a hunk, yes. But you do, I think, you know, it's such a good ensemble cast, and you have to be a good actor, you have to be an amazing singer. It, you know, it's just not, yeah, you have to have, be the total package to set, you know, to care. And I just remember doing this, you know, performing this piece. I mean, you know, you go through all these emotions and towards the end you're just like, you're just raw at the end.
You are. Mm-hmm. You are.
You know, and I know it's like that for the audience. So it's a good time.
Right. And so then it fits in with the theme here because of the redemption from the sins?
Is he redeemed? I mean, is he? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yes, it depends upon what you believe, right?
Yeah. I mean, is he?
Yeah.
But then, people are also committing a sin because they're committing him to death. I mean, we're not supposed to, we're acting as God, and that's a sin too. So, yeah, there's plenty of sin going around in this opera.
Yeah. Well, I was sinning a lot in that opera.
You were, yes. Jay was a prisoner, and he was a very good prisoner. And there's a scene where Sister Helen has to go into the jail, right? And your notes, you were told to watch. Oh, yes.
Hurl insults at her.
Yes, but then you had to not hurl them so much because you were an effective hurler.
Apparently, yes, I was an effective hurler.
And his voice carried. I mean, and some of the stuff coming out of Mr. Bittner's mouth was very, very prison-like.
Oh, my.
He's a very good prisoner. He's a very, very good prisoner. 5281 was his number. I don't know. That's a lie.
Who was singing her part in this recording?
Who was it?
The Sister Helen?
Yeah.
I know Joyce DiDonato.
No,
she's listed, no. I think, as the boy soprano for some reason. It must be.
Oh, because she was was in the Young Artist program when they premiered this or whatever, right? Because Joyce DiDonato was slightly older when she was one of their young artists.
Okay. No, I don't have the full listing here. It just has like all the names, so maybe it's...
Wasn't it in Flicka?
Could be Susan Metzner?
Frederica von Stade, yes. She was in the premiere, yes.
Yeah, but this is like I say, it's a 2012 recording. And I will put on the blog, there's some place, you know, where I can give you the whole cast for this, and I'll make sure that's there so you can know exactly who's singing.
Yeah, ours was quite.
Yes, ours was. Our Sister Helen was Teddy
Hansworth,
and she was amazing.
Yeah,
amazing.
Oh, rip your heart out.
Yes. It's a good. It's just such a good role.
Mm-hmm.
Such a good role. Good sing for everybody.
So number three, good wine, bad wine. Is it your friend again?
I'm loving it.
You love it.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I
really
like this one a lot.
I like it.
You like it? All right.
We're colleagues. Okay. Number three and I are colleagues.
Yeah, this one has a very floral nose, I think, which I like, instead of like straight fruit, which you get on the Zinfandels a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's not as tannic as the last one, so it's a little more friendly.
It's lighter in color than the first two, both of them.
But it still has a lot going on, though. Like, there's a lot of different flavors
in
there.
Yes.
I think I need to add some milk chocolate on the finish.
Some milk chocolate.
Uh-huh. Look at you.
Better than dirty socks.
Yeah.
Yeah, Yes, always better than dirty socks. No, it's a beautiful, it's live, it's lighter, but it has more, it still has more tannic structure than the first one. But it's got a lot going on. I like this one a lot as well. But this month we have bonus, so we have four selections and four wines. So.
Yay! Yes.
I love
gave
September.
The right month.
You did.
Indeed.
So we will move on to the next selection, and I'll pour the fourth one.
Well, I know whose it is.
Very good.
Yes.
Alrighty then.
Mm-hmm. That was beautiful.
Yes.
That was
yes.
my selection.
I know.
I love that everybody else went with my voice part, and then I went.
So that was.
That was "Steal Me, Sweet Thief" from Menotti's "Old Maiden the Thief," mm-hmm. and I do believe it's the Dawn Upshaw recording.
Ah, the it Dawn! Is. I knew it the, was the
yeah,
Dawn.
It's of course the Dawn.
I love the Dawn Upshaw.
When I was an undergrad, I had a huge like crush on her.
I have a crush on her. I dated a girl that looked like her.
She didn't know that's what. No. I was.
She doesn't have to know.
No. But, yeah. I'm not going to name names, so she'll never know. She'll never know.
You dated a lot of people in undergrad.
Whoa, wait. So anyway, back to the Menotti. And that kid is what we call a bird.
I think I was sick.
So I get some sap.
There was some sap. That's all I'm going to say. That's kind of like this song. I mean, like, yes. this woman needs a little woo.
Yeah, she needs. She wants to sin.
She does. Oh, she desperately wants to sin, and nobody wants to help her sin.
She's
but the music wants to help her sin. Right, so that's what I love so much about.
And you know, had I said this, I would have seemed so smart, like, 5 minutes ago. I would have said, because Dead Man Walking reminded me a lot of singing Menotti, because Menotti is, for me anyway, it's hard to get into the brain and the vocal cords, but then once it's in there, it never leaves. Right. And I feel that Mr. Hege's work was a lot like that too.
Yes.
The score was tricky to learn, and then once it was in there, hard to leave. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I sent this to Jay and said, don't hate me. Because we all have, like, there's, like, this love-hate Menotti thing in opera.
Yes.
But I was like, but this is it. This is what I'm talking about.
I think
there's nothing wrong with this.
And, and I don't know if anyone else in this room feels this way, but I really, for the most part, dislike singing in English. It is not, it's not, unless opera, you know, music theater, obviously, and another thing, yes. But opera, I feel that it's difficult. I think it's because
because, you know, we all, as native English speakers, have our own tendencies on how we speak our vowels.
Mm-hmm.
And when you learn a foreign language, you are learning the technique of what those vowels should be. And most of the time, you're learning how to sing in the language. You're not even learning how to speak in the language. So you don't have that speaking in the language thing to get in the way of singing in the language. And one of the things I often find is that, and I remember, you know, Franca at Gorez, right? From Peabody. She's a diction coach, Italian, and she would like get after me because I would like dirty up my vowels, because I totally would do that. And I think it's much easier to do in English. And so when you start to not sing a pure vowel sound, especially as you get into your, you know, extremities of your range, you know, there are certain notes you could sing anything on. You could sound like Harvey Fierstein, you know, if you wanted to. But you know, it's a matter of you know, that then you have the other vast other extremes of your range where no, you have to make sure you're not, you know, doing things, and that's why I think it's so difficult.
And so I think with this recording, and one of the reasons I love Dawn Upshaw and have a huge girl crush on her, is you understand everything,
yeah, awesome.
And it's not easy what she's doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's little annoying.
If you went to hear her in an English opera, you wouldn't need the super titles.
No.
Which there are many singers,
right,
even when they're in English, you need the
super titles.
Oh yeah. I think it's because she's so clear about, you know, she really approaches English in that way where it's just all about the resonance of the vowels and it like finding it so it just floats over everything else. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, she knows how to, on the sustained notes, to sing the pure vowel and then bring the diphthong so you understand what the accent is at the right time, as opposed to go to those things too soon or eliminate them completely.
Mm-hmm.
So then it doesn't sound like the word, you know, like instead of Lord, it's Laud.
Yeah.
Laud. Well, laud is a different word than lord.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And so that's one of those neat things that she does effortlessly.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That, you know, unless you were a singer, you really wouldn't take note of how difficult it is. Mm-hmm. You just, as a listener, you go, oh yeah, I understood every word.
Thanks,
so
Tom.
I think if anybody is listening to this podcast and working on this aria, you just need to listen to her.
It's a masterclass.
Sing it, because it really is. It's not an easy aria at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, and effortless.
Right.
And I think the orchestra on this was phenomenal. Zinman, who used to be here as conductor, he was the conductor of this, and this is... So the orchestra is the Orchestra of St. Luke's.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. They're very good.
I said they're pretty good.
They're pretty good. Yeah. That's not like St. Luke's Hospital, right? That's
a little different.
No. Yeah, okay. But yeah, I mean, they were a phenomenal job of supporting her and mm-hmm. just right there with her. And I actually, you know, it's funny, I didn't even think of this until just now, but like I remember Zinman conducted Powder Her Face when I was out in Aspen years ago. And I loved singing for him. I could tell he was kind of a singer's conductor, because he really likes the human voice as an instrument.
Those are the best conductors.
Yeah. Yep. He's not like a singer's conductor, like, you know, like bowing down and like, oh, whatever you want. But he really wants to make the human voice be the focus of that, whatever that work is, that opera, and wants to see them succeed.
Yeah.
That's so lovely.
Yeah, it is.
Doesn't happen a lot. So
I don't think he also appreciated my sense of humor, so I like that. Well, we had this one scene, and he was like, "I don't know how you're going to get your pitches there." We were the quartet chorus in the pit, or the pit chorus. I was like, "Oh yeah, we're going to get it right from here," you know. And
he just gestured to his butt.
Yes,
and you're not going to see that.
And he says, "Oh, they teach that in conservatory now." So yeah,
only the good ones.
Yeah, only the good ones, right? So. No, I mean, that adds so much. I mean, actually, when you first sent me this recording, I listened to all the recordings. I think I have one of the best things. Did you guys send me all these recordings? I listen to them, and I think about them, and I sit at my desk, and I, like, tear up and stuff when I listen to them. And
shut up. No, you don't.
Oh, yeah, I do.
Do sure.
Oh, totally.
Stop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Aww.
So, like, this one, I totally got choked up, and I'm like...
Every time.
And one of the things that got me was, like, I don't know how many times I've heard this song.
Yes,
you know,
you hear
because
it a lot.
It's in coachings,
yes. Oh,
and people are singing it, and you get a little bit tired of it, because it's like you know, I think I alluded to in an earlier podcast that Magic Flute auditions, where every soprano came in and sang Ake Fuels back to 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 back, and so I was just remembering how many times I've heard it played on piano. And even with really good pianists, it's just not like that orchestration at all.
No.
No, because then you get, like, the shimmer of the strings and everything. And when she gets to that, take my hands, take my cheek. And, like, when it builds,
yes,
and it's like,
yes, yes,
and
yes.
You hear all of that excitement and effervescence in the orchestration. Oh, my gosh, that part kills me every time.
Yes,
like,
yes,
oh,
yes.
Just stop.
Yes.
No.
Yeah.
I really feel for this woman.
Yeah. Need some Zen.
Yeah.
Probably some Zen.
Yeah.
Right.
One or the other. No.
Right.
Yeah. Wait, what are you doing?
I'm just thinking we should probably,
are we,
you know.
Supposed to talk about the
are
line?
We supposed to talk
no,
about
we should.
Four?
We should. I'm just preparing because I have to turn the volume down.
Oh,
okay.
It's getting worried.
Sorry.
I know.
You know. Okay, no, we should talk about the
Heather
line.
Wants to talk about the
oh
line.
My gosh, I love this one. I want to marry it.
This
I love it.
Marry
it.
This
I want
to
marry
me
it.
Is like a classic Zen for Bell. Like
perfect.
It has the nose is a classic Zen, it has the like the jamminess.
I get plum.
Oh, yeah.
Plum.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, and not like a jamminess in a good sense, not in like, you know, I'm eating grape jam, but
well, when I smelled it, the first smell I thought of was strawberry rhubarb pie.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which
I
is a very specific thing, but I smelled it. I kept smelling it going, is that what I smelled? No, that's exactly what
I think
what
I must
smelled.
Have smelled this thing like 25 times before I actually took a sip, because it just smells amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, I know it's got, it also has a nice tannic structure, but it's better balanced than any of the others.
Yes.
The fruit is beautiful and present, but it also has like some herbal notes to it, a little like white pepper on it. It's it's really
it's
a
lovely.
Gorgeous
it has
one.
A heft or something. It's like heavy, you know, in a way. Like it has a...
But it's agile. It's like an NFL player.
Well, I was going to say, I was going to say it's more like a ballet dancer. No. It's like muscular, but it is not heavy.
NFL player that does ballet.
Yeah, well, it would be a wide receiver, but it's not, you know, your linebacker or your, or you know, it's not your center, you know.
When Dancing with the Stars, he was on Dancing with the Stars.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
Yeah, no, it definitely, it has muscularity, but it's not weighty. It's, no, it's, you know.
It's my favorite.
Well, there you go.
I called it. I know it's premature.
That's right. Well, no, that's all right. I mean, no, it's fine. You know, why don't, because we had four, and we're going to listen to this. Why don't, you know, if you guys are, you can tell me what your favorite is. I'll pour you a little more of that while you listen to the, on the way to the dump section. So you're four, right?
I'm four.
Okay, you're voting for four. Anybody else?
Mine is three.
You're voting for three.
Yeah.
I mean, I go with four.
You're going with four as well.
What?
One.
Yes.
All right.
I don't vote one, but I did like one.
Yeah.
Like, I'm marrying four, but if one is still in the picture, no way.
You might have a little fling
like
right before.
If one stands up at the wedding and says, you know, I can't hold my peace, I will have a quadruple.
Ah, that's a good laugh. All right. So now we're going to do our From the Dump selection.
I'm so excited.
On the way to
the
dump.
On the
way
to
the
dump.
Yeah, that's right.
Legally, we have to be clear.
Thank you.
rehearsal or a performance archive? Do you know?
I really don't know, because the tape just had the title of the piece. Mm-hmm. It didn't even have the date on this
really?
One.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Wow.
But I can tell from the cassette tape mm-hmm. that it's from the 70s because of the
really?
Others. Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. I just love so much about this thought of like this, what we're connected to is that we've had so, I mean, generations and years and years and years and years of being part of this long tradition of all of these like extremely special moments that only so many people get to be in when you're in the rehearsal or you're mm-hmm. in the hall
right.
when mm-hmm. it's happening. And I just think that's so incredible and magical that you're like, you're one of the people that's standing on stage, or if you're the lucky, like gifted person who gets to sing that moment
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
it's, you're all just sharing in this really incredibly special moment where like the sound all happens in the way that you wanted it to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, and you're like, oh yeah, that's why. That's like, that's it.
Well, I mean like, and that last high.
Oh yeah, right?
Okay.
Profound.
Glorious. I talked about the 3 seconds I cut out. There are 3 seconds she holds that I cut out because it was
distorted.
A solid 3 seconds of distortion
wow.
in the middle of that.
She crescendoed it.
Which means she probably crescendoed it and crescendo, but it was so like.
Yeah.
But I was like, I'm just going to clip that out.
Again, what opera and the piece?
So,
oh,
right.
Yes.
So this is from The Merry Widow.
Yes.
And this is Viglia.
And it's funny because it's such a simple song. Oh do we don't know the
singer. I don't
singer.
Know the singer. I don't know the date.
She's
I don't
glorious.
Know the...
Oh, right?
Oh,
it
is.
Gosh.
It is.
Let's
loving. It's such a simple song. It's but at the same time, it's not.
Sometimes.
Right? Because it is exposed and she hits that, I forget whatever that darn high note is, but she hits it over and over again and it's And then at the end, you know, she sings it, and then she, you know, has to, then she hits an even higher note. It's just like, okay. And you, as the listener, you're like, whatever, it's no big deal. But as the singer, it is, as Megan said, it is deceptively difficult aria to sing, because it's supposed to be all folk song-y.
Yes.
But then you've got these like little moments.
But
of,
you are on a
like,
high wire of craziness.
And like messa da voce, like stuff that you really like. So singer wise, you're like, you're showing all the tools in the toolbox.
Right.
But you're like, oh, but shh, don't tell.
You know, I mean, it would be easier if you just stood on stage naked. I mean, that would be so much easier than singing this song.
Been there, done that.
Okay. Well,
now you're ready to sing Delia.
And that's why you were prisoner 8152. Naughty, naughty prisoner.
No.
You were arrested for indecent exposure, were you?
No.
Now, I always get grumpy with these on the way to the dump recordings because I get irritated at the way that they mic them.
Yes.
Because
mm-hmm.
it's very...
Mm-hmm.
However, I don't know... I assume, I was going to say, like, whoever the sound person was, the sound engineer for this recording, like, that is who they need to hire, because I felt like, I didn't get that in this at all. I felt that the singer, or I don't know, like, this seemed more,
yeah.
like,
there were a couple
really
times I felt like the orchestra was a little more present than it needed to be, a couple times, but nothing major,
mm-hmm.
which made me go, yeah, the mic placement kind of thing. But it seems to me like conductor was very sensitive to what needed to happen. I mean, which is what you want when,
yeah, right.
when you know, you're the, what's her name, Hannah or whoever, she's the widow.
Yeah.
You know, whoever the widow is.
And it is a beautiful moment. Because
yeah.
isn't this the moment that the young man falls in love with her?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't, I mean, it's got to, I mean, it's
right.
got to have some,
yeah.
Right.
You got to bring it.
Yeah.
Right.
Well. Yeah, I mean, so, but we don't know the situation. Like, this is not, like, obviously a recording that's intended for, like,
sales.
People to be, yeah, for sales or people to be listened to. So it's not going to be, I mean, this is sort of just archival.
But it's very well done.
Mm-hmm. But it is,
yeah.
but I mean, whatever, it just was
somebody
something
somebody in the
70s
knew what the hell they were doing,
either,
but the people in the 80s started effing it up, is what you're saying.
Well, all I'm saying is, like, whether it was this, like, happy coincidence that it was, like, the right voice with the right conductor and the right score that the... whatever the miking system they had worked well, or it was just done differently that they were able to use the like resonance space of the hall a little bit more than they do in the other some of the other selections we've heard.
It is recorded in a cocoon of loveliness, and I don't know.
Yeah,
why
it just well, it's helpful to know. You know what I mean? Like it's taking because there's a certain aspect to like how the hall is kind of part of the instrument. You know,
oh,
what
yeah.
I mean? Like,
yes.
You need to use that, and not all
yes.
of these recordings that we've heard. Is like necessarily utilizing the
right.
hall where I mean you hear like this the microphone's like right up against like the singer's face and then everything else is
that's one of
so
the things,
it's not helpful
yeah.
to the singer.
No,
yeah.
I remember all the time how when I used to record like stuff at Peabody, you know, with my little mini disc recorder
mm-hmm.
back in the day, I think I alluded to in an earlier podcast, and I would much prefer if we could like get like a Leakin Hall or something to record in because of what you were talking about,
yeah.
getting that sound of the space.
That it helps you. It's,
yeah.
It's so you know when it's a smart singer when they use the hall as part of their instrument. Like they've listened, they you start with all of the feels and all of the technique. And
yes.
then from there then you do your listening and you're like, this is where the hall helps me and I can just put it right into that.
I remember when I had just started with Opera Company of Philadelphia and I was watching some of the principals and they were walking through they're walking through the stage and one says to the other, have you found the sweet spot yet?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what are they talking about? What is this? So as a novice, I was like, well, I said, I think I should listen to what they're talking. And the one, you know, and the one was like, oh, the sweet spot's right here. So, you know, perfect singer voice. And I was like, oh, okay, good to know.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, you find out, like you said, you use the hall to your advantage.
Yep.
It's a living thing.
Mm-hmm. When you're in the right hall.
Right, yes.
Did you have like an aha Google?
I know,
moment?
It wasn't.
Did you Google something?
No, the Google led me wrong.
Bad Google.
I know, but for me, all these Baltimore Opera recordings, like, I'm being the daughter of an archivist, like, I'm just heartbroken that they're not in.
Yes.
Great shape, you know, they were kept in the basement of a warehouse, you know, where it was really humid, and now they live in our basement, which is not exactly the best place for them.
But they're on their way to the dump.
They weren't in the greatest shape to... But, I mean, can you imagine if we had gotten to listen to that without any distortion?
Oh, I mean, it was stunning.
You
jeez.
Know?
Like, if you were at that performance,
yeah.
like, that's, like...
Well, I might not have been born.
I think dates who were at that performance
yeah.
got laid that night.
Right.
I remember when Baltimore Company had their slightly unfortunate tagline of opera it's better than
oh.
you think it has to be,
oh.
you know, and I was joking with a friend and we were like, yeah, why don't they just say, you know, opera, you might get laid, you know, because like a lot of times you walk out of opera and you're in the mood, you know, it's, you know, maybe not at the end of Dead Man Walking.
No.
Dead Man
Walking,
but
you're like, I gotta
Dead
go
Man
to church.
Right.
I gotta do something.
Yeah.
I gotta donate.
I need to prove I'm alive.
I gotta, you know, volunteer my time with people. I have to say please and thank you more. Like, you know. Yeah, but there are some operas where you're like, yes, mm-hmm.
Well, okay, so I think we're long, a little long in the tooth because, you know, I added the fourth line and the fourth selection.
So
sorry to the listeners that we went a little over, but we should be at the point where we reveal the wines. Now, if I recall, we had Zoe like number one.
Yes.
Right? So that's what I'll be revealing them in order now. So number one, I'm going to cut open these paper bags, was Brazen Old Vine Zinfandel from Lodi,
oh.
California.
You knew it from Lodi?
It.
Sorry, I'm seeming like I'm like this educated wine person, and I'm totally not, but I do like Lodi wine. Like the Lodi...
Well, there's nothing wrong with
the
that.
The Lodi Zinfandels are, you know...
Your jam.
They're my jam. Yeah, totally my jam.
Actually,
yeah.
The Lodi,
Lodi
region has some of the oldest Zinfandel grapes in California.
Mm-hmm.
So...
You know, it's not that uncommon. And the reason the old vines are highly prized is because the the yields on the vines are so much lower. Excuse me, so you get so much more fruit flavor. But and actually, Lodi wines are sometimes a little more affordable because it's not, you know, the big name Napa, etc. So. Yeah. So yeah, that's it retails for usually around $15-16 a bottle.
Dang.
And this is the 2000. Oh come on, why do you hide the vintage? 2012 vintage. And I thought I agree with you. I think there was nothing wrong with it. Heck, it was your first love, Heather. So.
It was, yeah. And then I kicked it to the curb.
Yeah, never forget your first love.
No, but I don't. I won't forget you.
But yeah, it's it's a really pleasant wine. It's both easy drinking and would go great with soup. I thought it was a great choice.
Yes, good choice.
And it's very representative of a lot of what Zinfandel delivers on the whole.
Yes.
So that was really good. So wine number two, which nobody picked,
but it was
as their favorite.
It just needs to go in the cellar for four or five years.
Right. So it's a Pedroncelli.
Oh.
I'm sorry, Pedroncelli. Dry Creek Valley Zinfandel, and it's their Bushnell Vineyard,
okay.
2012 vintage. And Dry Creek Valley is in the northern, kind of western part of Alexander Valley, and so they're known for actually having more dusty, brambly, you know, Zinfandels, so that we picked up on that quite a bit.
They need some water.
It needs to be a wet creek.
Well then.
But and that retails for about 18, 19 a bottle, so not that much more.
Yeah.
And you're like, no, you're not gonna buy it.
Mm-mm.
Well, that's okay.
Negative.
You know. But you don't have a wine cellar to lay down in, right? So
I ain't got anything.
So number three is the Sin Zin.
Oh, oh, no. Oh, my favorite.
It is the 2012 vintage, and this is from Alexander Valley Vineyards, which is an Alexander Valley Zinfandel. So when I said Dry Creek Valley was in part of the Alexander Valley, so that's a smaller appellation within the larger appellation of Alexander Valley. So when you have smaller appellations, it means like the grapes all come from that smaller appellation. When it's Alexander Valley, they can open up and get grapes from anywhere in that valley. I thought this was a great, very representative Zin from Alexander Valley. It had those, it was a little lighter body, maybe a little more acidity component than tannic component. And I loved it. It had great raspberry, and like I said, I think I mentioned the milk chocolate on this one. I thought this was really nice.
This I brought one to replace it.
You bought one to replace it, right, in my cellar. Thank you, Megan. And
did you bring that?
Yeah.
Oh, that's adorable.
But like later.
And that retails for about like $17-18 a bottle. It's not really expensive either.
All right, number four.
Number four.
The classic.
Nobody was number two. Paige, you like number three, right? Mm-hmm. And then two, Megan and Heather like number four. And number four is the Joseph Swan Vineyards, Stellwagen Vineyards, Sonoma Valley, Zinfandel. So Sonoma Valley is the bigger valley, in which is the Alexander Valley, in which is the Dry Creek Valley.
Mm.
So bigger appellation.
So bigger is better.
Well, yes and no. The difference is, like, if you go to the absolute smallest, like a single vineyard, that means, like, the grapes all come from that vineyard. Well, that can be really good or that can be really bad.
Yes.
Like, what happens if one year the grapes that come out of that vineyard suck?
Then you're in trouble.
Then you're kind of trouble for that year, that vintage for the single vineyard. When you have a wider swath, you can be like, oh, I want to pick this, I want to pick that, and so you can make your wine. You have more choices.
I guess if they suck that year, you just make white Zinfandel.
Joseph Swan has been making Zinfandel for quite a number of years and doing it very well. I'm not surprised that this was the one you guys liked so much of that it had so many beautiful aromatics. Mm-hmm. This is 2008 vintage, so here's another thing. So Joseph Swan, one of the things he does is a little more Italianate in the sense of he you know, a lot of people know you. They harvest the grapes, and the year that they harvest the grapes is the vintage. So 2008 is when they pick the grapes. But you may not get it released in 2008 because they have to ferment it and then barrel age it or whatever. But in Italy, they also almost all wines they bottle age as well a certain number of years. And that's what Joseph Swan does as well. So it hasn't been sitting in wood since 2008 until it was released this year. It was sitting in the bottle. And the idea behind that is, like we talked about very early when you asked your question about, you know, aging wines and cellaring wines, basically that theory is, well, I'm cellaring and aging the wine for you, so when I release it, it's ready to drink.
I like that,
so to speak. So it's kind of that. It's kind of that philosophy in a sense. So yeah, that is beautiful wine, and that one retails for $34 a bottle.
That's about right. I'll take it.
But I guess that's the quality you marry, right, Heather?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
So I think we're going to draw to a close now. We're going to sip our wine as we do that. But Jessica, who's not with us, chose our playout song today. And she said that this is her life theme song.
Oh, geez.
And it is from her favorite singer ever.
Oh,
so here we go.
Oh, my goodness.
Enjoy.